Okay, thanks, Graham. My background is a primary school teacher, and I guess I'm passionate about learning and children's learning in schools. But I guess I'm also a bit of a geek, and I like technology, I like using technology, and I'm an enthusiast for the way it can help change the processes of interaction in the classroom. And that's really what my kind of core message is. I'm going to talk a little bit about how I see the research evidence, what I think it means, if you like, particularly in terms of what the implications are for schools. And in order to do that, I'll take a look backwards, retrospectively, what I think has and hasn't worked in the past, and what the lessons are for that for the application of new technologies in the classroom. We tend to think that because a new piece of kit comes along and it hasn't been researched, that we won't know how it can be effectively used in schools. And I think absolutely the opposite is true. We can use the evidence that we've got about where technology has been successful and where it's been less successful to predict what's likely to happen when some new widget or new idea hits the classroom. And throughout, what I'd like to do is to focus on looking for the learning. I thought I'd start by being a bit provocative, I guess. I've been working in this area for a number of years, and you often hear people enthusing, I think unhelpfully, about the value of technology. I mentioned before that one of the things that people do is they say, oh, because it's new, it must be better. And we don't need to think about what's happened before. We only need to look forward. I think that's a huge mistake, because there's so much we can learn from what's happened in the past that will guide us in terms of what we do with an iPad, games in the classroom, other new technologies as they emerge. But you also hear people saying that today's generation of learners are different. It's the digital generation. It's the next generation. And they learn differently. Well, so far as I know, in the past 50 years, we haven't evolved as a species in terms of the actual basic processes by which we learn. The contexts may change, but the actual process of learning, when you think of it from the individual's point of view, is very much the same. We haven't increased working memory capacity, so when we say that young children can multitask and do several things at once, yes, they may be able to coordinate their actions across those different tasks, chat on Facebook, listen to music, and do their homework all at the same time, but our working memory capacity hasn't increased, so they're diluting the attention that they can give to any one of those tasks. They might manage it well, but they're unable to think at the full level of their capability if they're multitasking. I think we also confuse the nature of knowledge and information. People say that in today's world, you don't need to know things because you can look them up on the internet. But I think I'd be slightly nervous if I was in hospital having an operation by a surgeon, if the surgeon said, oh, it's all right, I haven't done this before, I'll just look on YouTube, I'm sure there's a video I can look at before I operate on you. And I think we misunderstand the importance of expertise and fluency in terms of how we use knowledge. In order to become a reader, you couldn't possibly look up every new word. You have to have developed a basic fluency in letter sounds and comprehension in order to read text. To do more complex tasks, you need fluency with some of that knowledge to do advanced thinking. Of course, it's much easier to find things out using the internet, and that probably should change the way we teach some aspects of the curriculum. Finding, critiquing, synthesizing information may well be more important for the next generation, but I don't think the importance of expertise and a detailed knowledge base in a particular area will change. One of the biggest fallacies I think that people talk about in terms of technology is they say, it motivates children. It motivates and engages them. I'm sure that's true. Almost all of the qualitative evidence in research studies talk about the engagement of young people when they're using technology. And depending on the time and what's of political interest, there may be a particular comment about, oh, it particularly motivates boys. My question is always, what does it motivate them to do? Does it motivate them to enjoy and engage in the activity? Does it motivate them to use the technological tools? Does it motivate them to enjoy interacting with their peers as they undertake those tasks? Or does it actually motivate them to learn more or to learn better? I think the evidence shows from fairly rigorous studies that you can get an increase in motivation and no increase in learning. So we need to be very careful that we don't mistake that practical, physical, and social engagement as cognitive engagement in the processes of learning. The next two are about the way I think we see technology positioned in contemporary culture. Technology has certainly revolutionized a number of things that we do. In the 90s, I was really excited about email because only really my other geeky friends used it. So I only got messages from people I wanted to hear from or wanted to send messages to. Now everyone uses email, and I hate email. It's the bane of my life in terms of the amount of time I have to spend responding to people who seem to expect an instant reply. We don't have to use things just because they're there. I'm stuck with email, as I think the rest of us are. But just because there is a new piece of technology doesn't mean we should automatically incorporate it in the classroom. My argument, as you'll see as I go through this talk, is that it should be in some way better, more efficient, more effective. Act as a catalyst and change the teaching and learning interactions. But we should have a clear rationale as to why we think we can improve our practice with technology rather than just try something out because it's new. I think we're also starting to see in the accumulating evidence that we may have reached the point at which people will start deliberately not using technology in order to improve aspects of teaching and learning. The evidence overall from some of their major international studies suggests that the extremes of using technology almost all the time aren't associated with the best performing schools. There's kind of a Goldilocks effect where you need to get it just right and that more isn't always better. I thought it was useful to start by nailing my colours to the mast, if you like, in terms of those myths about technology. It will perhaps, I hope, help you understand where I'm coming from when I talk about the rest of the presentation. There, if you like, I think reflect my values about what I think's important in technology use. But we do live in a time when the adoption of technology is a characteristic of the education system in the UK, and particularly for those of us stuck south of the border. There's been huge investment in technology since the 1980s. The UK was actually the world leader on interactive whiteboard uptake, particularly in primary schools. That's an interesting comment, isn't it? World leader. It sounds like it's really good. Was it so good? Really interesting to look back and reflect on what the impact on that's been. Certainly, organisations like Vector, before they were disbanded, encouraged schools in England to promote learning platforms. And you see virtual learning environments commonly in both primary and secondary schools. There's been a big push for gaming approaches to be developed and used in schools, particularly with past government support, but that's also something that's being promoted actively now, partly because of the economic benefit of the gaming industry, both north of the border and south. In England, we've got a new computing curriculum, a way of making digital technology use hard and rigorous, according to the whims of our politicians. And I think north of the border it's much the same in terms of tablet mania. Tablets have been adopted and are being promoted widely. And I've got some cautions, I guess, about where I think that's valuable and where it might be more difficult. One of the real privileges of being an academic is it gives me time to research the things I'm interested in. And the area of digital technologies has been one I've looked at fairly consistently for the last 15 years. I suppose I'm a slightly sad research geek as well, in that I like to accumulate that evidence and think about what it means, not just each piece in isolation, but what the pieces mean in relation to each other. And that's part of what I'd like to share with you today. We tend to have a very positive picture about the use of technology from research studies, and my guess is that's because it's researched by people like me who are enthusiasts and who work hard to show that it is beneficial. But there are some examples of things that haven't been so successful. The key message that you get from that literature, I'm sure you won't be surprised to hear, is about the importance of pedagogy. It's about teaching and learning. And if I haven't convinced you about that by the end of the morning, I'll have significantly failed in my task. What I'd also like to do is take a glimpse and look towards the future. I've been lucky enough to be involved in a couple of research projects where we've been trying to develop more complex digital environments using multi-touch surfaces, and I'll talk a little bit about where that perhaps might go in the future. What we do know is that pretty consistently, over the last 30 years or so, when you look at the amount of technology in schools and how well schools do, or the amount of technology in homes and how well children from those homes do, there's a pretty consistent positive correlation. So schools that tend to use technology tend to be better schools. Homes that have provision of technology tend to have kids that do better at school. The mistake is assuming that that's a causal link, that if you take a school that isn't doing so well and give it the same technology, it will make it a better school. I think we made that mistake significantly in the 1990s. I don't think we're perhaps in danger of making the same mistake today. It may be that what made the schools good was that they thought about different ways that they could challenge, stimulate, engage, and develop the learning of their pupils. And that was part of the strategy that they used to provide a rounded, extended, or balanced approach to teaching and learning. And the evidence that's come out certainly in the last 10 years suggests that once you control the socioeconomic factors, there isn't as much of an effect as we assumed. So good schools in affluent areas, families with more money tend to have technology, and that's what the association is representing. I'd argue, and it'd be interesting to see your reflections later when we have some questions and also as you go through the day, I think it's important to think of optimal use. What's the best possible configuration we can get? Not should we just use more, but what particular teaching and learning challenges would it help us solve? I'm also particularly interested in more rigorous research studies, experimental trials, randomized trials. And again, the evidence is pretty clear that you get consistent, moderate benefit from where technology is added to the educational mix. So over time, people have tried rigorously to show that technology makes a difference, and they do. The trouble is that pretty much everything you try makes a difference, and a positive difference. Because people don't try things out at random in schools, they try things out that they think are going to be better. Unfortunately, most of the time, they do actually work. So the overall evidence base is positive. And if you just look at the technology research, you think, oh great, technology works. There are studies that prove it works. And that's what I meant before by saying I'm interested in the bigger picture. I'm interested in the way different areas of research relate to each other. And actually, when you look at technology, it produces average gains compared with all of the other interventions that are tried out. My interpretation of that, I can't prove it, but my interpretation of that is that people use technology in different ways, and it's the ways that you use it that make a difference, not whether or not technology's there. And again, I'd like to try and persuade you of that as we go through the rest of the presentation. Part of my work's out of the border is with the Education Endowment Foundation, Sutton Trust. We've now got the slightly uncomfortable title of the What Works Centre for Education and Schooling. I'm not sure I'm entirely happy with the idea that we've solved that particular problem. What's worked? Perhaps past tense, I'm happy with. We can accumulate the evidence about what's been successful in the past. And when you stack it up, digital technology, it's in the top half, maybe in the top third. If you're interested, go into the toolkit. You just Google EDF toolkit, you'll find it. What we did was, I guess, try and produce, what's the best description, a witch guide to education research. What's effective? How much does it cost? How good is the evidence? And then kind of stack them up in terms of what that looks like. My criticism of a researcher in digital technologies is we put everything into one giant bucket. Digital technologies. Well, what do you mean? Do we mean teaching machines from the 1960s through to the use of iPads today? Well, yes, it's not quite as big a bucket as that, but it suggests that where people use digital technologies to bring about improvement in learning, they're successful. And the average gain you get is about 4 months' progress. Well, that's actually quite encouraging. But you've got to look at the top of the list. What really does make a difference? And that will be a theme I'll come back to again as we go forward. What really makes a difference is effective feedback. And then the second top one is metacognition and self-regulation. So that's encouraging learners to plan, monitor, and review their learning. Self-regulation is about the role of the teacher in transferring the responsibility for learning to the learner. Kind of the holy grail of teaching and learning, I guess. If we could do that every Monday morning, our jobs would be enormously easier. My suggestion for some of the most effective ways to use technology is to think about the pedagogy first. You've got an iPad, what can this do to enhance feedback? What can this do to enhance metacognition? Learners' awareness of their learning. What can this do to help learners take responsibility for and regulate their own learning? So rather than focus on the technology, focus on the pedagogy. I mentioned before I'm a bit of a research geek, and I suppose the area where this is shown most is in the use of meta-analysis. Meta-analysis is where you aggregate studies, you combine the findings across different trials. It's used extensively in medicine, so when a doctor tells you that this particular drug is going to reduce your symptoms of blood pressure or aspirin's going to reduce the rate of heart attack, that's not just based on one study, it's based on the aggregation of several studies, sometimes even hundreds of studies. The same takes place in education. My worry, I guess, is that the precision of the average is a bit worrying. But overall, there are clear patterns in the research. So what we looked at again for the Education Endowment Foundation was trying to accumulate what the historic evidence about the use of technology suggests. And the evidence, I think, is very clear. There are patterns in that that help us think about the best ways to use new pieces of technology that haven't been evaluated yet. Collaborative use. Particularly where children work in small groups, pairs or threes, is more effective than individual use. So getting learners to work together, to talk together, is more effective than them using it on their own. In the research evidence, it tends to be effective as a short, focused intervention. That's where you see the biggest gain. That may just reflect the fact that you're bringing about a process of change which focuses attention on specific teaching and learning objectives. It's hard to be clear exactly what that means, because we're living in a world in which technology is becoming part of the background of the way that we live. Certainly outside of school, children are connected, mobile phones, on the web, gaming. They live in a very digital world. So that's one I predict we may have to think about as we look forward. We do know that for children who are struggling, that some kind of remedial, tutorial, or catch-up work is very effective and efficient. My guess there is it provides motivated practice. There are some things you've just got to do a lot in order to become fluent, and you've got to feel successful in that practice to achieve a level of mastery or confidence. And there's clearly a role for computers in that, although that isn't particularly fashionable at this point in time. Another challenge that I'm not entirely sure what to make of in today's climate is that there are greater gains when it supplements rather than replaces normal teaching. That may for me reflect when teachers identify that there's a particular problem and they look at technology as a way of solving that. And I'll come back to that point in a few slides. The other thing that we know absolutely clearly is that training and professional development are essential. What we tend to do is spend far too much on the hardware, possibly not enough on the software, a trivial amount on the skills training for teachers, and nothing at all on the pedagogical development and training. We really need to invert that pyramid. Where you see the most productive gains are where teachers have some time and support to master the skills that are necessary, but then work with colleagues or other experts to think about how the particular piece of technology can improve teaching and learning. If you get someone from Promethean to teach you how to use the whiteboard, they know an awful lot about the software, the tools, and how to manipulate things on screen. They don't know very much about your class, your children, and how you can best use it in your school. So that pedagogical development is absolutely essential, and I think the literature shows that really clearly. I think we can also learn valuable lessons, particularly at this point in time, from things that perhaps haven't been as successful as we hoped. I started my teaching career in the 1980s, where I was allowed for a whole term to play with a floor turtle, that odd green device in the corner, every afternoon for a whole term. Integrated day, I had a group, and I had the luxury of being able to use that kind of technology every day. Unthinkable now in the current curriculum climate and pressure on literacy and numeracy. What did we learn about Logo? We learned it doesn't particularly improve your computational math skills. And you kind of think, well, why would it? They weren't doing a lot of maths. They may have been doing some. But what they were really learning was precision of language, programming, and problem solving. And there is evidence that children improved on those skills, but they're not the core skills that we assess and apparently seem to value in schools, so that wasn't regarded as a particular success. It was also killed south of the border by the introduction of a national curriculum, which I think allowed you about 2 hours for Logo somewhere in year two, which meant that there wasn't any time at all to develop the skills in using and understanding the programming, which was actually where the benefits came from in terms of debugging, understanding, problem solving, setting your own targets and challenges. Integrated learning systems. Again, I'm kind of showing my age, I guess. 1990s, these were a real fad. They were, I suppose, maths and English textbooks put on screen that were marked for the children that they tended to do individually, sometimes even wearing headphones. It was sometimes slightly spooky going into a classroom, seeing all of the individual children sitting in front of something that looked like a language lab, but doing maths or doing English, doing exercises and getting feedback. What did we learn about those? That the systems reported much better gain than standardized tests. So it looked like the children were making really good progress when you got the data out of the integrated learning system. When you tried to triangulate that or check it with a standardized test, the gain wasn't nearly as impressive. So the children had learned how to do maths on the computer, but not how to do maths more widely. And I just kind of park that as an idea that we need to be careful at. Are they getting better at transferable skills, or are they getting skillful and routinized at particular sets of activities in the digital world? One-to-one laptops. Some lessons there, I think, for current one-to-one iPad initiatives. Some schools were very successful with these, particularly the early adopters, and I'll talk about that again a bit later. But when they were rolled out as a policy, particularly across a state or a school district, you very rarely got any positive effect at all, and in fact there were even some negative ones. People blamed lack of teacher training, lack of engagement. I think the answer is probably more complex. And just for the moment, I'll leave you to think about that, because I'll unpack it later. Talking books. Remember those CDs where you put in, what do we learn from those? Very engaging. The kids certainly spent a lot of time in the book, but they possibly didn't spend enough time decoding and comprehending in order to improve their reading skills. They were entertained by the talking book and were kept engaged for longer, but it wasn't any more efficient at teaching them to read. Interactive whiteboards. I was lucky enough, I think that's the right word, to get a contract in England to evaluate the first major initiative to implement whiteboards across years 5 and 6 in primary schools. We learned there that it did change patterns of interaction in classroom. It increased the pace of lessons, which Ofsted are very keen on the pace at the time, I think they still are. When we looked to see if it, and teachers loved them, and even more importantly, the children loved them. When we looked to see what difference they made in terms of tested outcomes, it was very hard to find any small at the end of the first year of the project, and after 2 years we couldn't find any at all. I guess what the challenge there was that the literacy and numeracy strategies at the time had decided they already knew the best way to teach aspects of literacy and numeracy. So all they did was convert what we already had on paper into activities for the whiteboard. So it simply replicated what teachers were doing anyway. And surprise, surprise, you got a little bit of gain because everyone was invigorated by the arrival of the new technology. But in the long run, it didn't make any difference because the pedagogy hadn't changed and the content of the curriculum hadn't changed either. So my question to you is, why will any of these be any different from the things that haven't worked in the past? You hear a lot about iPads, and in fact, I think you'll hear more about iPads later today. Khan Academy. People use that. I actually use it for some of my own statistical development. The stuff that challenges me as a researcher, there are materials that are appropriate, certainly for primary. One of the areas I think we are seeing a shift is the use of short video clips for people to regulate and manage their own learning. This is only anecdotal, but the number of young people I know who certainly don't bother with any sort of instruction manual, if they get, they'll tinker and try and work it out themselves, but if they get really stuck, they'll Google YouTube to find someone who can show them what to do. I actually had a similar experience just the other week with some new heating controls for underfloor heating. Looked at the manual, tried really, really hard. Several hours, in fact, of pressing buttons and getting nowhere. My nephew said, there'll be someone explaining how to do it on YouTube. He found the video, stood there with his iPad and showed me. It took me 2 minutes to solve that particular problem that I was unable to solve from decoding a piece of text. I think we will see development in this particular area. Gaming. I'll come back to that later, but all I'll say for the moment is that I worry a bit about the language that's used around gamification. There are clearly some things we can do in terms of challenging young people to understand their own learning and use gaming as a means to do that. It can help them get into programming and develop their own games. But I think gamification, the very term, should give us some concerns. We all know how to game the system. And one of the dangers in these particular tools and approaches is that young people learn how to succeed in terms of particular subsets of objectives. Let's give you an example from a primary school. This is quite a long time ago now, certainly 15 years. A program called Number Maze on an old Macintosh, Mac Classics, people remember those sorts of days. Number Maze was a program aimed at 4, 5, 6-year-olds. You chose a piece and took your horse or your car through a maze. When you reached a particular point in the maze that was a wall, you were presented with, for reception children, a counting problem. You were shown 6 apples or 8 horses or 9 dogs. And you had to count how many there were on the screen, type the number in, the wall would open, and you could drive your car or gallop your horse around the rest of the maze. I watched a young lad, let's call him for the sake of argument Tom, who was absolutely thoroughly engaged with this particular program, loved it, always asked to go on number maze. I watched what he was doing. He always chose the car, racing car. He liked the flags that you got when you crossed the different lines. Drove up to the first wall. 6 dogs appear on the screen. What does he do? He puts his finger on the 1 on the top of the keyboard and slides it along to the 9. Doesn't count at all. He knows that sequentially it'll put in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and that one of those will be right, and the maze will open, and he can move on. He gained number maze. His view of what the learning was about was that it was about getting through the maze and getting a certificate. He wasn't interested in learning to count. He wanted to drive through the maze. I think the experiences of that reception child should make us reflect on making sure we're transparent about the objectives when we gamify learning. Because unless the learner understands what those are, they'll find a way to complete the task according to their own objectives, which may not be the ones that we were hoping for. That brings me on to talking about how we get the most from technology. And I'd like to try a slightly wacky theory on you. You're probably familiar or have heard about the adoption of innovation cycle. I'm sorry, the blue's a bit light at the bottom of that screen. But basically it says innovations go through phases. You get your innovators and early adopters, then you get an early and late majority, and as you come down the other side, you get your laggards, and it's presented as a normal distribution. I think that's quite a useful picture to have in mind. Because I think where we go wrong with technology is we just see the technology in that cycle. What we don't see is that the innovators and early adopters see the technology and choose it as a problem solver. It lets you do something differently. So the early adopters of schools using iPads have thought about what it is this helps them do better. The school down the road sees that the school up the road has got iPads and they want to compete, so they get the iPads. They don't know what they're for, so they simply replace the things they were doing before with the iPad. It doesn't help them do anything better. So what happens is, because schools are such busy places, it squeezes out random bits of practice and doesn't really make a difference in the long run. The innovator, early adopter, if they're thinking about solving teaching and learning problems, use it to replace things that weren't as effective. So it squeezes out practice that wasn't as successful, and they genuinely get a benefit from that technology. As you go through the cycle, the late adopters and laggards who don't really want to use the technology anyway probably don't even use it to replace what they were doing particularly effectively. So over time, you get this sort of breaking wave effect of technology. The early adopters get benefit and enthuse about the difference it's made to the learning in their school. The majority try out the technology, and sometimes it helps and sometimes it doesn't. But on average, it doesn't make a lot of difference. The laggards use it, but they're probably not the best teachers anyway in terms of thinking about innovating, changing, and developing their practice. I'm absolutely not saying that you need technology to improve your practice. But you do need to be inquiring and problem-solving to think about what you can do better next time. And not all teachers are enthusiastic about that process of change. The question I always pose to schools when they introduce or implement a new piece of kit is, what's this replacing? What are you going to stop doing? Do you know what it's squeezed out of the already full day in terms of teaching and learning? Because most of the time we don't really think about that. We intuitively do something because we think it's going to be better. But just thinking about what is this better than can sometimes help justify exactly where, how, and why you might want to focus on a new piece of technology. So I think the evidence is really clear. How well you use it is more important than whether or not you use it. I guess, I suppose it's a bit like Bananarama for those of you of a certain age. It ain't what you do, it's the way that you do it. And that might help remember, although apologies if you get an earworm and you can't get it out of your head at the end of the day. But I think thinking about technology, it ain't what you do, it's the way that you do it, is probably a good way to focus. It's quality that matters. It's using it to address teaching and learning problems. I can't go today through all of the possible ways that we can think about how technology can help learning. And I certainly recommend this publication from Nestor if you haven't seen it. Because it just thinks, I think, productively and helpfully about the different ways that technology can help us change the processes of interaction, teaching and learning, and it thinks about the role of working with experts or working with others through actually designing and making things or exploring and inquiring, from practicing, from the role of assessment, the way it can help bridge learning across different settings, home and school or in the community. So if you're looking for inspiration and ideas, I certainly recommend this as a place to think about the range of ways in which technology can help. But the key issue is what actually improves, what changes. And for me, the important thing to focus on is not so much what the teacher does, although of course they may be able to give better explanations with an interactive whiteboard and a nice visualization. They may be able to give more feedback or more accurate assessment. They may be able to change the level of challenge, as Graham mentioned earlier. They may be able to use their time more efficiently. But what they do isn't going to make a difference to learning unless the learners do something different. There's no shortcut to learning. You can't plug in and download things into your brain, at least yet. So they're going to have to work harder in some way, or for longer, or more efficiently. They may develop better understanding that helps them aggregate or accumulate information to a better model, so it's more efficient in that sense. It might be that there's more depth to their learning. Or they might develop better learning habits, again, which in the long run are beneficial. But the learner's got to be doing something differently if they're going to be learning better. And that's really hard to spot. As I mentioned before about motivation, it's really easy to see changes in activity and assume that those changes in activity mean that the learner, because they're doing something differently, is learning better. It's really tricky to see in a classroom. Is this leading to better learning habits? Well, you certainly can't tell that after a day or so. Are they developing better understanding? Well, again, that's really hard to do at a particular point in time. So we take proxies for that. We look at their engagement and their motivation at a particular point in time and assume that's going to carry forward and be beneficial. I think the evidence suggests that's dangerous, and we need to get much more sophisticated about identifying what the causal mechanism is from the introduction of new technology that will actually help learners learn. Okay, I'm going to look at a couple of examples. One's old, one's relatively contemporary. Both of them, I think I can explain what I think it was beneficial. We do know that each of these particular activities or tasks were part of a program of activities that led to improvement in learning, at least as measured by standardized tests. We don't actually know what the mechanisms are, but I will try and explain. The first one, anyone remember? Apple eMates, little kind of green handbag-like devices that use the Newton operating system. Again, an interesting history of a technology that was a bit of a cul-de-sac. They were early touchscreen laptops, I guess, probably the best way to describe them. We didn't really use them as that. We simply used them as a sophisticated timing device, basically a stopwatch. But a stopwatch where the child didn't have to press the button, it was kind of controlled by the pressure mat. And what we were trying to do was teach young children, 8, 9-year-olds, about decimals, two places of decimals, because that was important in the curriculum at that particular point in time. The first challenge was how fast can you run? So, stood on the mat, took your foot off, timing starts, run up the wall, touch it, come back, stop. Do it several times, collect small, collect numbers where the smallest number is best. Depending on the length you run, 12 seconds or so, perhaps a bit less. But what the children needed to focus on, because the times in which they moved were relatively close, they were looking for the smallest number. The second challenge was standing on the pressure mat, then jumping. Time starts as you leave the mat, stops when you come down. Really small numbers generated, but the biggest number is the one that you're looking for. So the children really had to focus on the two decimal places to understand who's the fastest, but who stays in the air the longest. It's what John Dewey would call, I think, psychologizing the subject matter. Getting the children to understand where the numbers come from, what they mean, in order to help them make sense of the mathematical notation. What the children also did, became fairly enthusiastic about the task, went further than we'd actually intended, because they started to want to run multiple trials to see who did best of three. That lets you introduce averages. We didn't let them use a calculator or a spreadsheet to work out those answers. We made them work them out by hand in order to focus on manipulating the decimals. Obviously, in the future, you'd expect them to be able to use a spreadsheet. But that wasn't part of our task. What we wanted them to do was to focus on that decimal number knowledge. Why do I think it was effective? I think it acted as a lens that helped the teacher and us as researchers focus on the learning. A lens, perhaps, or another metaphor would be as a piece of elastic. It lets you stretch out the bits you want so you can focus on the things that are really important in terms of understanding what's a tricky concept for children of that age. Their experience of decimals tends to be money, and they tend to see decimal numbers as two separate things. One half of the decimal point and the other half of the decimal point, and not understand them as a single quantity. The timing map simply acted as a sophisticated stopwatch, but it stopped them cheating, starting the stopwatch. It made that part of the activity not necessary to focus on pedagogically, so it was backgrounded. The technology wasn't used to do the calculations, deliberately so, to get the children to do that mentally and on paper. Their natural competition at that age encouraged them to undertake multiple trials, so they were keen to go on and keep doing this for a period of time. So the technology and the task, I'd argue, successfully engaged them. The pupils actually extended it into their own time and tried things in the playground, like skipping, where they could continue to manipulate the specific data that they generated relevant to themselves. It wouldn't have been impossible to do without the technology, but it would have been a lot harder to manage and organise. Okay, let's look at a more recent example. I mentioned before I've been lucky enough to have a whole room full of digital toys to play with as a researcher. We looked at the use of multi-touch surfaces in a project at Durham, and what we were interested in doing was trying to design an environment where digital information, I guess, could flow around the room relatively seamlessly. And I'll talk about one of the activities that we designed as part of that. Okay, I'm going to show you a video clip. I'll play it a couple of times because it's quite short, but it gives you an idea about the... if I can get it to play. Teacher's actions on the second table. Who's the one person who can't get that network flip activity to work? We laugh about that, but it is interesting that the young children had no problem at all in adapting to the environment. That was one of our orientation tasks. The children didn't need the orientation task. The teachers did. Okay, what we did in that environment, that all of the computers were connected, so you can move what's on one table to another table, onto the whiteboard, back, freeze the action. It makes you think slightly differently about the relationship between task and resource in a primary classroom. What we were interested in doing was trying to develop children's, in the research language, adaptive expertise, but I guess that's their fluency and their creativity in coming up with mathematical solutions. Maths isn't normally associated with creative solutions, but that was one of the things we were keen to do. So they had numeric keypads. They look a bit like calculators, but they're actually just keypads. And they can generate expressions that have to match the target total at the top, 75 in this case. The table is set up so that you can't repeat a solution that someone else in your group has found. So it's efficient to work together as a group, and over time, it's efficient to develop strategies to solve that particular problem. If anyone remembers Broken Calculator from older days, it's got some of those features, which again I'll talk about. So, target number at the top. You can try and solve what's on your table, generate solutions, perhaps over 2 or 3 minutes. Teacher then freezes the action and moves your solutions and your target number onto the next table. So you've got to work out what the previous group's done, so you don't repeat, because that takes time. And then that group's second set of solutions are added and move on to the next table. After 3 iterations, by the time the fourth group gets 75, all of the easy ways of solving that particular problem have usually been used. So you've really got to think about the strategies that the other groups have tried. At the end, we also got them to try and link and see patterns in their calculations that we thought would help them identify strategies in the long run. Hard to know from our experiment if that was successful. The features of the teacher control were partly inspired, as I mentioned, from Broken Calculator. Teacher controls this from an iPad, so you can monitor what's going on around the class. You can rotate, freeze the tables and have some flexibility with that. But you can also disable keys on individual children's calculators as you go round. So you notice that David is relying on addition calculations. You can knock the addition with plus button off that particular keypad. Another child may be relying on multiples of 10, so you can remove the zero key. Now that's dangerous, because unless the class are up for the challenge, they just find it really, really annoying that the teacher keeps making it harder. But in the classes we worked with in a lab environment, they were up for the challenge. So we could really stretch the children and push them out of their comfort zone or into other particular strategies. We could also make it competitive between groups by showing and hiding the totals. You could also correct calculations, so you can drag them back onto your keypad and edit them and send them out again if there are mistakes. And we actually discovered unexpectedly that the children were passionate about not making mistakes. They not only wanted to beat the other group in terms of the total they got right, they wanted to beat the other group in terms of the number they hadn't got wrong. So it was interesting the way competition worked. The tools were designed to collect feedback and give that to the teacher. This again was challenging because the quantity of information, a bit like an integrated learning systems, is simply overwhelming. So we decided on a very simple stock market, red and green, correct, incorrect, that lets you monitor and look for patterns of error. This is some of the work that's been done in the area of learning analytics, if people are familiar with that field. We can potentially collect a huge amount of data of learning as it takes place, learning on the fly. And that kind of information may be useful for teachers to help them make decisions. It's just difficult to know at the moment when that's useful and when it's simply overwhelming. One of the things we found here was that the children were really keen to learn from each other. So this is an example of two of the boys, Jack and Adam, looking at the calculations they've just inherited from the previous group, the green group, the little coloured borders around the edge of the calculation boxes. So Jack says, "Who done? Who's green?" "Jiminy, that's quite smart." And Adam sees what he's looking at and says, "Look at that. 10 times 10, that equals 100. Add 50. Now that's clever, whoever did that. I'm doing that." It's one of the stages the children go through. Because of the way we teach maths, they're not comfortable about combining operators in a calculation. They tend to do addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, and one of the things we wanted to see is that they could be creative and combine operations. Someone does it, it spreads around the class like wildfire, and everyone wants to try that. What was effective? Well, clearly, they were just doing a lot of sums. They were pitching them usually within their comfort zone to start with, but the task was designed to push them out of their comfort zone. We did this as a trial and compared the number of calculations that the children did on paper and on screen. And at the beginning, they were slower on screen because it obviously takes you longer to manipulate the number keypads. But over time, their fluency with that increased. And they certainly came up with a greater range of calculations and more creative solutions to the challenge. So they were as good as doing it on paper, where they tend to stick to the same solutions that they'd already developed. It encouraged them to be more creative. I think it also worked because the level of challenge was self-regulated. Yes, the teacher could push them out of their comfort zone, but they decided in what areas they wanted to explore. The teacher gets feedback about both the competence but also the confidence of the kids involved. Important dimensions as a teacher. We do the confidence thing intuitively and don't write it down, but it's an important part of assessing how children are learning. It's interesting our assessment systems focus so much on the products and the evidence of competence, where the relationship for me between competence and confidence is central to how you develop more self-regulated learners over time. In this, the teacher could also tweak the level of challenge. It's always hard in a classroom, mixed ability task, to get the level of challenge that actually does stretch all of the learners. And it's unusual that in a classroom, during a task, the children are able to learn from each other quite so explicitly. I think it worked partly as well, given the ages of the children, because of that balance of collaboration and competition. I think we know from research that the best way to manage that in the classroom is to put the collaboration at group level and the competition between groups, because that's the way you maximise the benefit but maintain the social cohesion. So, how should technology be used for teaching and learning? Well, after what I've said, this shouldn't come as too much of a surprise. I think you've got to adopt technology as a solution to a teaching and learning challenge or problem. You've got to have a hypothesis about why this is going to be better. Otherwise, it probably won't be. I think that's what the research shows us. And of course, you've got to check that technical basic skills don't get in the way, so it's no good trying to teach redrafting if the children don't have sufficient keyboard skills to enter the text in a way that they can then edit it and improve it. I think you also want to make sure that the technology helps learners accept a high level of challenge. I think that is one of the areas that technology is valuable for. They are motivated to use technology, but you want to make sure that you then set a high level of challenge to capitalise on that motivation. I think it's important to look for evidence of improvement. What's got better? Not just their motivation and stickability of the task, but is this actually leading to improved skills, knowledge, understanding, confidence? What is it that's improving? So that means evaluating the impact. I don't mean evaluating in the sense of a research experiment, but using professional knowledge and judgment to work out what, in terms of learning, is improving. So I think the questions are, what are the teaching and learning challenges that digital technologies can help you solve in your schools? And I'd just like to float the idea of a complementary pedagogy. There are things we're all good at in terms of teaching and learning. I think one of the things technology allows us to do is to try something different. So what is it? What's the area that you think would complement what you already do well? Extend your thinking, challenge the children. How do you balance what you're already successful at and extend it with the technology? And crucially, what will the technology replace? How do you know what to stop doing? Hardest question of all. Because otherwise you'll stop doing things that might be equally valuable, or you'll stop doing things that actually lead to successful learning. We usually launch technology into a context and it squeezes things out. And we don't really know where it went. What did we stop doing? So that's, I think, a really key issue that we know very little about from the research. And how will you know it's better in terms of teaching and learning? But my final thought is this. Teaching and learning is a really complex problem. And that we know that for every complex problem, there's a simple solution that's neat, but wrong. Thanks very much.